Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Jonathan Bennett joins me. We're going to be talking about open source and Instacluster, great ways to scale your Apache Cassandra instance. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Jonathan Bennett. Episode 516, recorded February 6, 2019. Open source at Instacluster. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, Libre, open source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at Stonehenge.com, bringing you each week the movers, the shakers, the big projects, little projects, projects you may be using every day and be unaware of it, projects you might want to download and play with right after the show. Today is probably one of those. Joining me once again is my lovely and talented co-host, Jonathan Bennett. Jonathan, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Randall, it's good to be here once again.
Cool. And you're in a new house, right?
Yes. So it's been about 4 weeks, I think, since I was here last. Okay. And goodness, the break has been nice because we moved into a new house with a dedicated office and had our first kid. So I'm back, not on quite as much sleep as normal, but I think we should be good to go. I'm excited to be here.
Still in flyover Oklahoma?
Yes. Same city, just different side of town.
Okay, different side of town. Did you move up across to the right side of the tracks now?
Same side of the tracks, actually. We're closer to the tracks. In fact, every once in a while we get woken up and we can hear the train going by.
Okay. And I am back in ZipRecruiter today with my nearly infinite bandwidth, which is really good. I really like that. I'm plugged in on an RJ45 cable and my upload and download speeds are close to 1 gigabit each direction. So is that right? 1 gigabit or 1 terabit? Gigabit. Whatever it is, fast. Very fast. Okay, I think it's a gigabit. The lovely picture behind me is Manhattan Beach, the nice dock that's here. And I remember the first time I was in this room, we were commenting they look like some sort of spaceship. So let's get into the show. We're going to have, I got to pull my notes up again. We're going to have Ben Bromhead, who is the CTO and co-founder of Instacluster. We're going to be talking about the open source contributions that Instacluster is making to a few really interesting projects. They've created this thing called Cassandra Operator, which is a connector for Apache Cassandra. And they also have a thing called the LDAP Authenticator plugin that also works well with Cassandra, and a Kerberos Authenticator. So these are all things I don't know a whole lot about. So I'm sure we're going to have Ben describe a lot of this to us in short words that I can understand it. And we'll bring him on in just a couple minutes. Jonathan, anything else you want to say before we start the show?
So I am not exactly familiar with this technology either. I tend to use virtualization rather than containerization. I still have some minor holdouts about the maturity and security of the containerization. I'm not real familiar with it, but looking forward to learning about it and hopefully being able to ask some intelligent questions. Who knows? This may be the show that finally pushes me over the edge and I say, all right, containerization is for me. It's a high bar for our guests, but I'm sure he's up to it.
Right. Well, speaking of that, let's go ahead and bring Ben. Scrolling into the wrong place. Somebody's screaming. Let's bring. Can we start over again? No. Let's pick Ben Bromhead on. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, and congratulations, John, on the new arrival.
Thank you, sir.
Cool. And where are you calling? Where are you calling? Yeah. Well, where are you speaking to us from?
I am speaking to you from, at the moment, sunny Boston. It was kind of funny. I was actually in San Francisco in the Bay Area yesterday. Mm-hmm. They got snow in Oakland. They got snow in Bernal Heights. And it was like 60 degrees in Boston that day. So the weather's a little bit backwards, but it's a nice change.
Cool. And that accent doesn't quite sound American. Where are you from before this?
I do definitely talk a little bit funny. I'm originally from Australia. So please bear with me as I struggle to translate to American English.
Yes. You know, when they say things like, people who speak English are separated only by the common language. So, yes, a little strange that way. Anyway, so give us a 30,000-foot view. So we've got these – you're introducing or you've already introduced these three projects. Can you kind of give us sort of the problem each one of them solves?
Yeah, definitely. So maybe a little bit of context as well. Sure. These projects that we've released, these three projects, they're really kind of around the periphery of Apache Cassandra, right? And InstaCluster, we're a managed service for Apache Cassandra, so we run it so you don't have to, and you get all the wonderful goodness of doing Cassandra, but without as much of the pain. I would like to say any of the pain, but, you know, hey, it's an OSQL distributed database. There will be pain. And these three projects really aim to make developers' lives a little bit easier depending on what environments they run in, right? So for the two security-based ones, the Kerberos Authenticator and the LDAP Authenticator, what that does is it allows the Apache Cassandra database to actually authenticate users connecting in from external authentication servers. And the two kind of main authentication schemes most people use is LDAP and Kerberos, right? So it makes it a little bit easier for those in enterprise environments to be able to adopt those and to have, you know, permissions and groups and users flow from, you know, their corporate directory into Apache Cassandra, right? So that's the two security-based ones. That's the Kerberos and the LDAP authenticator. And the third one is the Cassandra operator. And what that does is it makes it easier for people to run and manage Apache Cassandra in a Kubernetes environment, right? So it kind of bakes in a little bit of the operational knowledge, you know, that you kind of need to have to run Cassandra, and it allows you to do it in an effective and safe way on Kubernetes. So that's kind of the 30,000-foot overview.
Cool. And just for the people at home that don't know, can you describe a little bit more about what Apache Cassandra actually is? What problems does that solve?
Yeah, sure. So Apache Cassandra is a distributed NoSQL database that came out of Facebook almost 9 or 10 years ago. It really focuses on availability and partition tolerance, but giving developers the ability to choose kind of what level of consistency they want based on the nature of the, you know, the operation or the query that they're running. It is based on the Dynamo architecture, so it is a masterless architecture. That means any node can serve any query, and it knows how to route it to the right node that has the data relevant to that particular query. And it uses the Bigtable data format under the hood. Typically, where you'll see this being used is where companies have kind of reached the limits of their existing databases, whether that be, you know, Postgres, MySQL, Oracle, and they're looking for something that's a bit more scale out. Alternatively, for companies or use cases that have kind of, you know, a high resiliency and a high durability requirement, Apache Cassandra treats or has a certain amount of awareness of the locations that you're deploying the infrastructure. So it has things like data center awareness, rack level awareness, and it understands those as what I'd call like separate fault domains. So if that one fails, whether it's a rack or a data center, you know, your data is still distributed effectively, and you can still access it based on, you know, how you've configured it, right? So it really solves those two key requirements of high scalability and high availability.
So I wouldn't necessarily use this as, if I only had like, I don't know, 3 or 4 dozen tables and 50,000 rows in my MySQL database, I probably wouldn't want to go into the trouble of wiring up Cassandra, right?
Correct. And in fact, one of the things that you'll find with Apache Cassandra is it makes a number of trade-offs that most developers will be used to when running an SQL database, right? So some of those trade-offs include things like foreign key constraints and, you know, that kind of relational safety. It also gives up things like, you know, joins and, you know, those deep kind of queries that you can do. By giving those up, you get that scalability and that availability, right? So it's a set of trade-offs. And for most people that are kind of, you know, running, I guess, smaller workloads or workloads that don't have those requirements, I would say 100% stick with whatever database you're familiar with, because the pain isn't worth it. But, you know, if you've kind of reached the limits of those databases, Apache Cassandra is an awesome solution to look at.
And this is a schemaless database then, right, as well. So that's why you don't get – you lose foreign keys and things like that.
So it back in the days when NoSQL was kind of like that, you know, that hyped thing, you know, early, you know, 2014, 2013, right. You know, Cassandra was a little bit more schemaless. So, you know, you didn't have to define your columns up front and that kind of thing. As the project has matured, people very quickly realize that your application always has a schema, whether that's explicit or implicit.
Yes.
And defining your schema up front is generally the best thing to do. So Cassandra is it has a schema. The way you define it kind of looks similar to SQL, but you know, you need to know those columns and those partitions up front.
Okay, so one of the things you released is the Cassandra operator to make it possible to work closely with Kubernetes. What was the problem there? Why did this need to be created?
Yeah, so one of the things that we saw with a number of our customers and out in, I guess the market and the environment is that a lot of people are looking at Kubernetes as a common API or a common scheduler for working with containers, right? Mm-hmm. You see a lot of companies, you see a lot of development teams starting to want to use Kubernetes as their primary API for interacting with their infrastructure. Kubernetes started off very much geared towards stateless applications, right? So it was very much built around containers that you could, you know, spin up. It would probably serve some sort of, you know, workload, but if it had to reschedule them somewhere, you didn't have to worry about state. You didn't have to worry about what happened if you just pulled it down and started it up somewhere else. Right. As Kubernetes has matured, and the community has evolved around that, people are like, hey, I want to, you know, run my database this way. I want to do things with that. And Kubernetes itself has started to build in primitives that allow you to do that. But at the same time, you know, Kubernetes doesn't understand how to do certain operations with certain databases, right? And a good example of this is with Cassandra. If you want to, say, scale the database down, so you want to remove some servers that were participating in that cluster, there's a number of things you have to do with Cassandra first up in order to do that safely so you don't lose any data, right? And that would be, for example, you run a decommission operation, which causes the server that's leaving to stream all the data that it has off to the other nodes, right? You need to tell Kubernetes that it needs to do that. Otherwise, it'll just be like, hey, I'll just delete this pod and, you know, off we go. So the Cassandra operator is kind of a little bit of, a control loop or a little bit of, you know, an extension to Kubernetes that allows us to bake in some operational knowledge around how to run Cassandra. So people can then install the Cassandra operator in Kubernetes and, you know, it will be the thing that manages Cassandra for them, right? So essentially what it's doing is we're trying to bring an easy Cassandra experience into environments that our customers and that our users want to be in, right? And that's Kubernetes. If it was something else, if it was, say, for example, let's say, you know, Docker Swarm was the most popular container scheduling API, that's where we'd be. You know, it's just a matter of listening to where people want to be, where they want to go, and, you know, making it easier for the environments that they work in.
Yeah, I know here at ZipRecruiter, there's a lot of activity going on now to Dockerize everything, make everything, you know, 12-factor sort of way of thinking. Mm-hmm. And I think they're using Kubernetes as the orchestration system as well. So this seems like it's very appropriate here. So are you dogfooding these? Is this the things you're actually using internally to do these projects or to do the hosting solutions?
Yeah, so we've been using containers to run Apache Cassandra for probably about 5 years. So definitely before it was a good idea. Before we used Docker containers, we did things like using SmartOS and Solaris Zones to do that. So we've got a lot of experience in running Apache Cassandra in Docker containers. Because we adopted containers so early on, we had to build a lot of the schedulers and the orchestration components ourselves. So at the moment, we're still very much running on our homegrown scheduler. But as the popularity and maturity of Kubernetes has kind of grown, we've very quickly identified that, hey, we can replace a good proportion of what we've built in-house with Kubernetes. And we get all the benefits of participating in the community, right? So, you know, we leverage that common good. We can give back to it. And, you know, it makes our lives a lot easier in that sense.
And
but,
so
you know, because I was just going to say, because Kubernetes, you know, it is still maturing. You know, this is really us dipping our toe in the water. We have one production cluster that is running on it. You know, so our metrics capability that we use to store statistics about, you know, the various clusters and technologies that we manage on behalf of other people. You know, we do have a data center that is being run by the operator. But at the same time, you know, it's part of that slow adoption and making sure we do it in a controlled method.
So how was this decided to be made open source? I mean, I'm sure you had something internal you were using, and then all of a sudden you decided, hey, let's give this out to the community. And what was the process for that?
The process was actually, we just started building it out in the open. And the thinking was that we want to make Apache Cassandra easy to use and operate, where the way we try and this is kind of, this gets onto some interesting issues that have been kind of kicking around the open source community, which is like, how do you monetize open source, right? Mm-hmm. We do things a little bit different at Instacluster in that we thoroughly believe the way that you monetize open source is around support and services. So by releasing, you know, something that helps people run Apache Cassandra, we figured that, well, yes, it's open source. It is definitely competitive to our managed service in some regards because it does some of the same operations. Yes, that's true. But what we tend to find is that our customers find far more value in, you know, the operations, the 24/7 support that we provide, you know, the safety that we provide. And that's kind of how we've looked at trying to, you know, build a solid business around open source, is very much down the services path rather than, you know, trying to build an open core product. You know, we certainly have code that is in-house to us and that is, I guess, proprietary. But the reason behind that is that it's probably not that useful for people outside of Instacluster. It's built specifically for us to manage our own workload. And the Cassandra Kubernetes operator is kind of our first step to kind of generalize those little pieces that we've built that is in-house and release that and make that open source.
Is this the kind of thing that I could use in an open source manner for a while and then decide, no, I'd really like Instacluster to host my data because they've got, you know, better scaling and better capability and maybe cheaper in the long run? Is it the kind of thing that I could fairly easily migrate my data and my design like that?
Yeah, very, very much so. And I the end goal is actually that, you know, you can use the Cassandra operator, you can run it in, you know, your own Kubernetes environment, whether that's on-prem, on the cloud somewhere, in a hybrid fashion. And, you know, when you get sick of running it yourself, when you're like, hey, actually, I don't want to have to hire another, you know, five DBAs to manage this fleet, you know, it's easy to outsource that to Instacluster. The flip side of that is actually, we're not trying to do anything proprietary in this particular sense. There's no kind of like proprietary lock-in, whether it's through formats, whether it's through extra custom code. So, you know, if you're like, hey, let's get Instacluster on board, and then, you know, 6 months later, you're like, hey, these guys suck, you know, you can go and you still get that same capability. So it really puts the onus on us to do a good job by our customers and really live and die by the quality of the service and the operational capability we can provide to them.
And given that you've been using Cassandra for a while, have you been contributing back upstream when you find bugs and stuff?
Yeah, very, very much so. So everything that we run and provide to our customers, we just run the open source distro. So whenever we find bugs and we have to, you know, write patches or hot fixes, you know, we generally will roll those out first to our customers. But, you know, in parallel, we're upstreaming that to the project. So yeah, that's kind of our approach. And you know, we've managed to build and grow a pretty successful business out of that. You know, we're growing 100% year on year. There's the kind of figures that would make any VC backed software business, you know, kind of jealous, but we're trying to do this as much out in the open as possible and, you know, without restrictive licenses.
Cool. And I'm looking at the GitHub here and it looks like there's 11 contributors. Are those all in-house or are you getting outside contributions already?
We're already getting outside contributions. We actually reached out to a number of our partners, particularly Pivotal, and also some of the folk at Joyent. And you know, they've been a huge help in contributing and testing. You know, we've certainly done the lion's share of the work, but you know, you got to build this with a concept of community from day one. And you know, that's how we've started to bootstrap it.
And we had a question from the chat room. I saw earlier. Emily the Strange, a frequent person in our chat room, said, and I'm not sure exactly how this fits, but is this OpenStack portable?
Unfortunately not. It very much targets the Kubernetes API. It is OpenShift compatible. So, you know, I guess that's kind of, you know, Red Hat's, you know, next offering beyond app OpenStack. I have to admit, I am not a huge expert in the OpenStack ecosystem. I wouldn't be surprised if being able to deploy Kubernetes within an OpenStack environment becomes very doable and very easy to do in the not-too-distant future. But, you know, I'm kind of speculating.
Hey, Ben, I want to jump in for a second and ask you, tell me about the company Instacluster. What, how did you guys get started and what's the kind of the core of your business?
Sure. So Instacluster actually got started like all good companies doing something completely different. We were kind of working on one of the problems of like working with high value data sets and the problem that people tend to find in, you know, having to bring, you know, data sets that they get in from the outside world and clean them and fit them into a schema and, you know, get it all kind of working nicely with their existing data. And what we were trying to do with that was, you know, kind of build a capability in a system where you interacted with them kind of more like you would in a data warehouse. So, you know, these, you know, foreign data sets would just be purely, you know, that'd look like tables in your existing, you know, MySQL or Postgres database. One of the problems that we had with that is that, you know, all these different data sets that we're working with, you know, would be hosted all over the different parts of the world. And, you know, we had to look at a scalable, highly available, you know, data store to kind of just hold those, right? And Cassandra kind of came up as the primary choice for that regard. We had to spend a lot of time building tooling and workflows just to run and operate Cassandra. You know, it can be hard enough to set up and install and you know, get a standalone relational database up and running. But when you're having to do that across a distributed system, it can be challenging, and there's additional operations associated with that. So, you know, after we built a lot of that tooling, you know, we kind of like 1 week we thought, hey, let's throw a website together, throw some credit card billing in front of it, and we kind of released it just as a managed service. Next thing we noticed 3 months later, we had like five production customers on it, you know, doing, you know, real stuff that was revenue impacting. And I kind of looked at my co-founder and I was like, we should probably do this properly. so that's kind of how we got started on that path. And, you know, we kind of been building that out from then. And so, you know, we really got started first and foremost, you know, essentially just providing a really nice, really good managed service around Apache Cassandra. As time went on, we noticed our customers using other distributed technologies to help them kind of solve those scalability and availability challenges. And, you know, we thought, hey, maybe we could also help run those pieces of their infrastructure for them. And so we first started supporting Apache Spark. So that's a distributed computing framework. You know, a lot of our early users just used that purely as like an ETL tool, getting data in and out of Cassandra. We then also last year released support for Apache Kafka as well. So that's a streaming and a message bus kind of platform. And that's proved to be, you know, very, very popular as well. We're also in the process of working towards providing an Elasticsearch service, so kind of more for that full text indexing and search use case. And really, it's just grown around looking at what other open source technologies our customers are using, what they're having trouble with, and how we can potentially lend some of our operational expertise to that. And as we've adopted each particular technology, we've also started to build a core open source team around those technologies. And that core open source team is very much geared towards contributing back to the community, fixing the bugs that we find in our customer base, and patching those and getting those back upstream, but also implementing features that are useful for our customers and getting those back upstream as well.
I love the way that came together. And in a lot of businesses, there is this moment where you finally realize, yes, people are using our stuff. Oh, no, people are using our stuff. What do we do now?
It was a little bit startling. And to be honest, it was, it was a little bit of like those first few months. It was like, we just kind of built it and they came. I wouldn't recommend that for any other business, but that's kind of what happened, to us. We kind of only launched it with like a single blog post, and kicked that out to the mailing list. But, I think it was, we kind of struck a problem that a lot of people were having, we kind of just iterated off that.
Have you found yourself serving a space very similar to Amazon AWS?
Yeah, definitely. 100%. Which, it's an interesting space to be in. We kind of knew that from day one because, Amazon had competitive technologies like, DynamoDB already available. So, we did kind of what the opposite of what happens to a lot of startups, which is, they create a new technology, a new project or a new service. It starts to become moderately successful. And then, that year at AWS reInvent, Amazon, swiftly stomps all over it and releases their own version. And you can hear kind of the gnashing of teeth from the vendor hall around announcement time. But we kind of did it the opposite. We go, hey, this, huge multi-billion-dollar company is already doing something and they're doing it well. Let's do that too. But it's working. So that's good.
What's the big differentiation between Instacluster and Amazon?
There's a few things. I think it comes down to the fact that Apache Cassandra is open source, right? So whereas you look at what DynamoDB is and it's proprietary. Not only is it proprietary, but you can't take it to different other environments. So it's a fundamental form of cloud lock-in. So we work with a lot of companies where they might be 100% all in on AWS in terms of spend where they run their workload, but they're making tactical decisions where, the technology that they're running allows them to be portable, right? So that's one of the first reasons. There's also some really good technical reasons where you would use Apache Cassandra over, say, some of Amazon's other offerings. Just on a purely technical basis, Cassandra tends to be more cost-effective than DynamoDB when you have a high density of queries or operations per gigabyte stored. If you use a lot of storage, but you don't have many operations going to the various rows in your database, DynamoDB tends to be more cost effective. But if you have a bit more throughput going through, then Apache Cassandra tends to be more competitive, or particularly on price. The other one as well is Cassandra has really great multi DC support or multi-region support, and really treats it as a first-class citizen. So you can, control consistency between DCs, within DCs, control replication that way. And that's kind of a little bit more lacking on some of the Amazon projects. They're certainly getting better at that with, say, DynamoDB streams. But at the same time, that's just effectively like a replicated log across to another DC rather than controlling consistency between them. So there's some good business reasons why you'd use it. There's some good technical reasons why you'd use it. That tends to be the type of customers that we work with.
So part of the answer to that question, of course, was that this is open source, what we're working with, and so you avoid vendor lock-in and things like that. And this seems to be something that's baked into Instacluster. And I'm curious, where did this very open source friendly mindset come from? Was there an early meeting where you guys sat down and said, open source is the way to go, let's embrace this? Or was it just kind of natural?
I think we were more generally guided by our customers, and they said, this is what we want. This is what's valuable to us. And, you know, we sat down and we listened to the reasons why. And, you know, instead of seeing that as a challenge to a business that we're trying to build, you know, we actually saw that as a key differentiator, right? So that's kind of where it came from. Like I 100% will put my hand up and say I'm not an open source purist. You know, if someone wants to go and write a bit of software and, you know, sell it for money and keep it, you know, and license it to themselves, you know, more power to you. But I think fundamentally in the long run, you tend to see open source catch up and, you know, in some cases surpass those. And, you know, there's just a number of qualities where actually, like, even on a very practical level, if you step away from, you know, say some of the moral arguments where, you know, I think open source tends to win in business.
Sure. And so dovetailing off of that, these projects that you've released, what is the license that you've chosen for them?
Apache 2 licenses. So, you know, effectively do what you with. What you want with them, you know, but just keep that notice on there. And, you know, I think having a very permissive license, we've seen that be really powerful for other companies. You know, one of the things that is really great about Apache Cassandra is that the IP is owned by a foundation. So it's a top level Apache project. All the IP is owned by the Apache Foundation. What that means is it gives companies that build products on top of Apache Cassandra, whether they're embedding it, OEMing it, whatever that might be, they've got a level of certainty around what they can do and how they can include that in their own project and distribute it, right? You know, so there's people that make, say, like call center software that's based, that, you know, uses Apache Cassandra as its underlying data store, right? Imagine what would happen to those projects, you know, if you had one of those situations where they had the license changed and yanked from under their feet, right? So having a nice license like Apache 2.0, we believe drives better adoption and builds a better community around this.
So speaking of licenses, it seems that there was a bit of a shakeup recently with Confluence, one of the big companies around the Apache ecosystem, doing some licensing changing. What's going on there, and how does that affect you guys?
Yeah, so Confluent changed a number of projects that they owned, not Kafka itself. Kafka is owned by the Apache Foundation as well. But Confluent has built a number of projects that they have open sourced, and they'd released those under the Apache 2.0 license. And, you know, they changed those to, I think, what they call a community license, where you can't effectively offer that software as a service or in competition to Confluent, right? So it was very much drawing a protective moat around their particular offering. And so that was things like their REST API, KSQL, their schema registry, all things that were previously Apache 2.0 licensed, all things that involved substantial changes within Kafka to support. You know, so because they own the IP, they can change the license. That's definitely up to them. But it's, I think it's kind of going to be a bit of a Pyrrhic victory for them. You know, that over time you will start to see community participation drop off around there, because it's very clearly, you know, this is open source as long as there's no competing commercial interest. And, you know, while not everyone who's in a open source community has necessarily a commercial interest, you know, it tends to be people that get paid to do open source work that do the lion's share of contributions. So, I mean, I don't want to crystal ball too much, but I think, you know, Confluent probably could have found a different way to compete with. And I think their primary concern was Amazon, right? You know, because Amazon did release Kafka as a managed service. And I think that was their primary concern. But I think it's potentially harmful to the community and probably detrimental in the long run.
So I'm not too familiar with that particular license, but I think you're talking about something that would be equivalent of the Creative Commons no commercial license, right?
It's even more specific than that. It's you can use it commercially, but you can't have it compete with Confluent.
What does that mean? That's too bad Simon Phipps is not. Simon's really good at sorting that sort of stuff out. So I'm just poking around your GitHub, and I see that the Cassandra operator still says project status alpha. And at the bottom, it says don't use this in production yet. What is the timeline for this? When do you think you'll have it in a production-ready state?
So we are hoping to have it kind of production-ready by end of Q2 this year. We also tend to be a little bit more risk-averse when it comes to open-source projects versus things that we're running internally ourselves. The reason why it's still got the big fat alpha warning on it is, you know, there are APIs that are still changing. There's functionality that's still changing. We run it internally ourselves. We're doing some POCs with a number of our customers as well. Definitely very functional and usable, but it's if you're just going to go and grab it and then throw it into production and, you know, run it on a kind of tier zero, tier one application, please don't. I think it's us just being a little bit more cautious and we'll get there.
And it was pushed out to GitHub in April of last year. So, was it even usable back then, or was it, I mean, it must be like you were also building the code for it internally.
That's more a reflection, the speed in which, it's been developed. We've only had a very small team, me included, working on it. So we are stepping up, resources around what we're doing with Kubernetes, and that will see, the velocity in which we develop the operator increase. It's certainly been, a very long tail project, and, you know, we're just kind of starting to pick up and start running with it, well and truly.
Okay. And, I'm just poking around the rest of your GitHub repo here, and I see, things like, fantasy player analysis.
Yeah. So not only, do we make useful things, but we also like to publish example projects that people can use as templates, or they can see how things are done with the various technologies, right? The fantasy analysis was actually looking at fantasy sports when it comes to like Major League Baseball or basketball or NFL, using some analytics and a little bit of data science to, hey, who should I pick, right? So it's just an example demo, kind of project that one of our engineers put together and thought it'd be, a great place to kind of show off, hey, this is what you can do with Apache Spark. So.
And I'm a little puzzled because many of these projects say updated on December 4th of last year, and all the same date, which doesn't make sense if you're actually using GitHub as your central place that you're making commits. Are you making commits somewhere else than squirting it out to GitHub?
Yeah. So I believe the December 4th was actually a update we made to a lot of readmes just around support status for various things. Yeah. So, there are certainly a number of projects where, particularly the examples, some of the more stable ones, like some of our Cassandra tooling that doesn't need to change that much, you'll see various commit dates and that kind of thing on that. We tend to do at least a good proportion of work internally. We do that on our internal GitHub repositories and then look to ship that out. That's kind of changed with the Cassandra operator. We've been trying to do a little bit more work out in the open so that people can see the development process. They can see, the personal forks where people have been experimenting and trying different things with different branches. We ourselves are still learning how to try and do this stuff a bit more out in the open, which is also part of like you know, when you're a service provider, it's very easy to, you know, just work from a closed Git repository because you're the primary consumer of that code, right? You use it to run and manage these open source technologies for other companies. So you get very used to kind of working in that particular manner. But with the Cassandra operator, we're like, hey, you know, we're going to do something different. We're going to, you know, do what every other open source project does, which is, you know, work out in the open.
Cool. And what's it like to test something like this? I mean, there's a lot of moving parts to this, I presume.
There is. In fact, you know, if you're looking at kind of the maturity curve when it comes to Kubernetes, kind of like testing the components that go into making it work is a challenge, and it's certainly something that will probably get improved upon as time goes on and as more and more third parties start working with it. But you know, our integration tests run for a few hours because you know you got to stand up environments and do different things and run distributed databases, right? So you're kind of building systems upon systems, you know. So it is work, definitely.
Cool. And we're almost out of time, believe it or not. So the hour goes by fast. Is there anything we didn't ask you that you want to make sure our audience is aware of before we let you go?
No, I think that was it. That really covered things. It was a great chance to kind of talk outside the little sphere that is our community. You know, one of the things you tend to notice with open source projects is, you know, everyone's kind of, you know, head down, tail up, kind of, you know, working on what they're doing. And you can kind of get involved in the minutiae of, you know, those particular projects. But being able to talk you know, to an audience that is interested in these kind of things, but might not necessarily have a use case or have touched or experienced them. You know, it was exciting for me.
Is there any particular skills that you're lacking in the community that you want to send a shout out to for?
Yeah, we're definitely hiring. And you know, we are definitely looking for people not only internally, but if you just want to work and contribute on that project. You know, it is probably one of the hottest skill sets to start to develop out there if you're looking for a nice line on your resume. And that's, you know, Apache Cassandra, that's Kubernetes. You'll get to work with two great programming languages, or one great programming language, depending on your opinions of them, which is Go and Java. And you know, I think the community will be richer for anyone looking to get their hands dirty in that space.
And you mentioned that like NoSQL was sort of hot back in 2012, 2013. Everybody was talking about it. Well, the latest buzzword is blockchain. So I'm asking, when are you going to add blockchain to this?
You'd need another hour for me to give you my opinion on blockchain, particularly as something like real distributed systems engineering.
Yeah. and two final questions.
It's a solution looking for a problem.
Yes, and a really weird solution looking for really strange and solved problems. So even weirder, I guess, for all that. My two final questions, as I ask all developers, which is, what's your favorite programming language?
It is Java, because I am an absolute sucker for pain.
Okay. I agree. And what's your favorite text editor?
I would have, honestly, right now, it is Visual Studio Code. I love that. I think Microsoft has done an amazing job with that. It can load large text files, unlike Atom can. And hey, actually, like, just randomly, a massive shout out to what Microsoft has done in terms of building a solid open source culture. So good on them.
Yes. And I'm trying to get them on the show here, too. I keep talking to them at various conferences, and they keep saying, we'll get back to you, and they never get back to me. So I just tweeted them. I just said, hey, Code, I want you on my show. Please contact me. So we'll see if that happens soon. I'd really like it to happen. I'm an old Emacs guy, and I'm an old guy that uses Emacs, and used Emacs for a long time. But I got started with Dart and Flutter, so I needed a much more structured environment than Emacs would provide. And so I've been using VS Code now, and I've been very happy with it, because they have Emacs bindings as one of their installs. So,
oh, nice.
Yay. So my hands already know what keys to press and everything, and I'm super productive with it because there's an Emacs binding for it. So
yeah,
that was
yeah.
really, really nice. Cool, cool. Hey, it's been great having you on, talking about these three projects, talking about how your company is contributing to open source. I wish you success in the future, and we'll just keep watching the projects, see what's going on.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Randall. Thanks so much, John.
That was Ben Brombed talking to us about open source InstaCluster. What did you think there, sir?
I think it's really neat that they have a company where rather than and nothing against the companies that are ideologically driven, but I think it's neat that they're just driven by the market to embrace open source. I think that's really cool. I think that's a win. I also think there's definitely something to look closer at with what Confluent has done with their licensing changes. Because, and this may be what you were thinking of, the Commons Clause, Redis and MongoDB have recently embraced the Commons Clause, which is a very similar language with a very similar idea. And that is, how do we keep Amazon from offering the same services that we're offering and pushing this out of the market?
Right.
I think it's so interesting, though, that InstaCluster did this the other way around. They said, well, what's something that Amazon is doing that we can do better? And it's just neat to hear about their success and the way that they've gone about it.
Cool, cool. Well, let's talk about upcoming guests for a moment. I'm going to spend a few more minutes than I usually do on that because we only have actually one upcoming guest scheduled, and it panicked me, freaked me out this morning. We only have one, and especially because they canceled next week and they rescheduled for 3 weeks from now. So now I've got a gap of at least two shows that I've got to fill really quickly and then fill the rest of March out. So it's going to be interesting. So we're scrambling behind the scenes. We're doing the best we can on our team. If you go to the big spreadsheet, it's linked from twit.tv/floss. You can see that there are very few things there. I sent out 22 pieces of email yesterday to the possible upcoming guests that I've been contacting regularly, but the odds on any one of those actually coming back to me are pretty low. So if you know of any project, I mean, many of you are involved in open source. Obviously, you wouldn't be, a regular listener to this show. If you know of any project that wants to be on next week, for example, have them contact me, merlin@stonehenge.com, because I really need to fill that slot. It's my job as a showrunner to make sure these slots are all filled, especially important when we have sponsors. And we have a couple new sponsors actually coming up soon. So that's going to be really interesting. So please email me, merlin@stonehenge.com, even if it's just the name of the project. I'll hunt it down. Just email me and let me know, because I really want to make sure those slots get filled. We have a live stream at 9:30 a.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays at live.twit.tv. There's a chat room that goes along with that. We do take questions from the chat room from time to time. You can follow us at Floss Weekly on Google+ for just another month or two. I'm going to have to find another solution for that. I thought the Floss Weekly one would not go away, but it's only G Suite. Google+'s that won't go away. Anything else like the Floss Weekly pages, which are actually a brand account under my personal account, those will go away coming early April. So we'll figure something else out. You can follow me at Randall L. Schwartz on Google+ for now, and at Merlin on Twitter. I'm going to be at Scale in just a few weeks from now in Pasadena in early March. If you're attending that, please. If you see me on the wandering the streets, I guess, wandering the hallways, not the streets, won't be out just hanging out on the sidewalk. Please come up and say hi and let me know that you listen to the show and all that sort of stuff. Anything you want to plug there, Jonathan?
I'll just mention that you can follow me at JP_Bennett on Twitter. Get my random technology musings, licensing issues, occasionally politics, although I try to keep my nose out of that one on Twitter. Because there are enough people pontificating about politics already. Other than that, just it's a pleasure to be here once again.
Cool. And Keith512 in the chat room just said, someone should fork Google+ and make Google++. I like that. That's pretty cute. So, all right. So we did it this week. Hopefully we'll see you next week with a project. If not, it'll just be a couple of co-hosts and me chatting, I guess. I don't know. We'll figure out something out. Okay. We'll see you again next week on Floss Weekly.